And next we will hear from Joe Baldacchino, President of the National Humanities Institute.
Like leaves, I'd like to thank Bill and Julie and everybody else who's had any role in putting together this excellent gathering. Our purpose at this meeting is to reflect on sources of American renewal. Within this context, I have been asked to suggest steps to restore some semblance of vitality to a once vibrant constitutionalism that has become moribund. In the early years of the Republic, the Constitution was among the genuine determinants of the nation's public policies. The better officials in all three branches of the national government actually supported or opposed governmental actions based on whether, in their judgment, the actions were to be found among the federal government's delegated powers. Nowadays, politicians play lip service to the Constitution, but rarely do we witness public officials voting against policies that they would otherwise favor, or vice versa, on constitutional grounds. Actually, more frequently, we witness politicians expressing reservations based on the Constitution against certain policies, but supporting them anyway, as the President most recently did with regard to the campaign finance bill. So in this context, it's apparent that any reawakening of effective constitutionalism will require a fundamental change in America's predominant political ethos. But before such change can occur, images of alternative reality must be conveyed that are sufficiently appealing that the public and its leaders will be motivated to transform them into actual reality. Those images must project a workable constitutionalism that promises a better society. Where are such potential realities to be discovered? They will not be found anywhere neatly packaged and ready for use. Such potential modes of existence must be fitted, first, to our permanent needs, but second, and equally important, to the changing historical circumstances in which our quest must occur. This blending of oneness and change, of the universal and the particular, requires the active working of what Irving Babbitt termed the higher imagination. But sound imagination does not work in a vacuum. For the changes it envisions to be practical, not utopian, it must find its inspiration in the great works and deeds of history. If we hope to stir a new awakening of constitutionalism in this country, a good first step is to systematically immerse ourselves in American constitutional history along with the English history from which it emerged. For the past several years, the National Humanities Institute has been conducting just such a project, and I have participated in it along with other scholars. For myself, at least, studying the constitutional history of our country in depth has been a startling experience. Though I had been aware that our system had strayed from the strict path of constitutionalism, I did not know how flagrantly our rulers violate, to the point of inversion, the Constitution that is our birthright. For purposes of illustration, I'll give three examples. Many will be surprised to learn that the Constitution allows the states potentially limitless powers, known as powers of police, that although recognized by the early courts as wholly immune from federal interference, are now usurped with abandon by the federal government. Considered a direct attribute of sovereignty, these powers include the authority to make all laws within a state's territory for the protection of public order, safety, health, welfare, morals, and just about anything that might be in the public interest. Included are laws prohibiting or regulating murder, violence, fraud, obscenity, intoxicants, narcotics. The list is potentially endless. Chief Justice John Marshall, though a renowned champion of strong national governance, declared in several landmark decisions that the general government had no jurisdiction over such matters except where authorized by an explicit grant of power, such as the power to punish counterfeiting given in Article 1, Section 8. Yet today, the general government routinely asserts its dominance over health, education, welfare, the environment, public policy, criminal justice, and other matters that constitutionally are police powers belonging exclusively to the states. A second example concerns immigration. In Federalist Number 2, Hamilton cites as essential supports for a union of the states, quote, that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, and very similar in their manners and customs. Today, the federal government is failing to slow the flood of immigrants who exhibit little or no interest in making America's traditional institutions their own. As concern over immigration mounts, most Americans are unaware that under the Constitution of the Framers, the states enjoyed extensive authority to regulate immigration into their territory. In the 1849 passenger cases, a divided Supreme Court split 4-4 on where the power to regulate immigration lies. The division, however, was not over whether the states could regulate immigration, but whether the federal government also could do so. Even the four justices who did support a federal role went to great lengths to stress that no power of the federal government could compel the states to admit undesirable aliens, such as, in the delicate formulation of Justice Greer, quote, lunatics, idiots, criminals, or paupers, unquote. And he was the liberal. Meanwhile, Chief Justice Taney and three other justices insisted that the regulation of immigration, being a police power, was a matter to be addressed solely by the states. As Justice Woodbury explained, quote, it is for the state to decide on what is sufficient cause for excluding aliens, whether sickness or crime, danger of pauperism, danger to health, danger to morals, danger to property, danger to public principles by revolutions or change of government, or danger to religion. Yet today, the federal government controls all aspects of immigration. Federal judges routinely deny the states any means either of controlling the admission of aliens into their territory or of protecting their citizens from resulting tax burdens or other ill effects. Turning to the third and final example, perhaps no other regulations of the federal government are more harshly administered than those concerning the use of land. What many Americans, including even members of Congress, don't know is that the framers intended that the states, not the general government, would possess ultimate control over all land within their territory. To assure that this always would be so, the framers inserted in the Constitution a requirement that the general government obtain permission from the state legislature before purchasing any property within a state to be used for federal purposes. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, which gives the federal government exclusive jurisdiction over the District of Columbia, allows it, quote, to exercise like authority over all places, and here are the significant words, purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Why this was done is spelled out explicitly in a few brief paragraphs of Madison's Notes of Debates in the Federal Convention. The relevant passage is as follows. On the clause, quote, to exercise like authority over all places purchased for forts, etc., Mr. Gerry contended that this power might be made use of to enslave any particular state by buying up its territory, and that the strongholds proposed would be a means of awing the state into an undue obedience to the general government. Mr. King thought himself the provision unnecessary, the power being already involved, but would, and here are the key words, move to insert after the word purchased the words by the consent of the legislature of the state. This would certainly make the power safe. Mr. Gouverneur Morris seconded the motion, which was agreed to nem. con. And that's the end of the quote of Madison's notes of what actually occurred at the Constitutional Convention. So it all boiled down to so that the states would not be intimidated into an undue obedience to the general government. The general government would be dependent upon the states for any acquisition of land within their territories. It's pretty simple. For more than 80 years, when the general government wanted to build a fort or a lighthouse or a post office, Congress would pass a statute requesting that the appropriate state legislature cede land to the general government for the purpose. The state legislature, at its discretion, would approve. And if suitable property was not available on the open market, the legislature would use its reserved power of eminent domain on behalf of Congress, the latter having no such power. But then, in 1875, the Supreme Court's decision in Cole v. U.S. literally inverted the previously existing relation of the two levels of government concerning land use. For the court, Justice Strong wrote, quote, the powers vested by the Constitution in the general government demand for their exercise the acquisition of lands in all the states. These are needed for forts, armories, and arsenals, etc. If the right to acquire property for such uses may be made a barren right by the unwillingness of property holders to sell, or by the action of a state prohibiting a sale to the federal government, the constitutional grants of power may be rendered nugatory, and the government is dependent for its practical existence upon a state. This cannot be. The court completely ignored that this dependence of the general government on the states was precisely what the framers had intended. Strong went on to argue that as the states derive the power of eminent domain from their sovereignty, the general government should have the power as well, since it, quote, is as sovereign within its sphere as the states are within theirs, unquote. This last inference is particularly disingenuous. For part of the state's retained sphere of sovereignty was the ultimate control of all land within their borders, except for any that had been ceded. It is impossible to give ultimate control over state territory to the federal government and still to leave ultimate control with the states. Recognizing that this power could not reside in two places and believing that to put it in the general government would make hash of the state's reserved powers, the framers made a conscious decision to leave the eminent domain where it had been, with the states. In its ruling in Cole, the Supreme Court brazenly flouted this explicit intention of the framers. Soon, the framers' worst fears were realized. Over the next 21 years, the previous sovereignty of the states with obliterated root and branch. The following summary of another Supreme Court decision that took place in 1896, just 21 years after the one I just mentioned, the summary of that ruling in Chapel v. United States, taken from fine law, says all we need to know. Quote, "The fact that land included in a federal reservoir project is owned by a state, or that its taking may impair the state's tax revenue, or that the reservoir will obliterate part of the state's boundary and interfere with the state's own project for water development and conservation, constitutes no barrier to the condemnation of the land by the United States." End of quote. So what you have is, for the first 70 years of the Republic, the states had to get permission of the federal government even to buy private land that was voluntarily for sale. The federal government required permission of the states even to buy private land on the open market, which any citizen could do. And then suddenly, within a span of 21 years, the Supreme Court has turned it on its head, and the federal government can go in and force the states to sell. You saw how plain it was in the convention. So I thought this was a particularly egregious example. But at any rate, all three are examples of far-reaching changes that have been inflicted unlawfully on our nation's constitutional practice. Many others could be cited. What is important is that these changes have all but destroyed the federalism and the government of checks and balances that the Constitution was meant to guarantee. How has it come to this? The most obvious culprit has been the Supreme Court. Hamilton, in Federalist 78, wrote that of the three branches, the judiciary would, quote, always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it was to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment. Yet if the court's incredible ruling in Cole is not an example of will rather than judgment, I do not know what is. Will may be the least of it. The murder of federalism with malice aforethought might be a more apt description. How might such judicial activism be discouraged or its effects minimized? In keeping with the judiciary's responsibility to exercise judgment, not will, I think the court itself might do well to adopt as a rule of jurisprudence that in matters of constitutional interpretation, older precedents be given more weight than recent ones in the absence of compelling evidence that the former were in error. This rule would be the converse of that governing interpretation of statutes, which holds that where laws are in conflict, the most recent act of the legislature is controlling. But the courts are not entirely to blame. Ours was to be a government of checks and balances in which all three branches were to protect the Constitution by jealously guarding against abuses by the others. But with few exceptions, the intended competition among the branches and levels of government has broken down. As a way for Congress to reassert its duty to the Constitution, I proposed several years ago that it might establish committees or one joint committee on delegated powers with responsibility for determining the constitutionality of proposed legislation before it would be allowed to go to the floor. A similar purpose might be served in the executive branch by the appointment of a constitutional advisor to the president. Significantly, the mechanism by which the president can promote a revival of effective constitutionalism is already present in his veto power. While the Constitution provides that the president may object to a measure for any reason, I think it is significant that the first six presidents, from Washington through Quincy Adams, used the power exclusively to register constitutional objections. And not once during all of those years was a presidential veto overridden by Congress. Here, then, are a few examples of how knowledge of our constitutional past can alert the mind and imagination to new possibilities. Revisiting the historical record and entering the outlook of the framers can be a source of inspiration. We may not want to return to the prescriptions of the framers in every detail, but awareness of their thinking is a prerequisite for revising their ideas via the amendment process. Without it, we do not even know what the Constitution was and is. If I might make one final observation, as the president of a humanities institute, it is that no amount of factual evidence concerning the true meaning of the Constitution will be effective absent an elevation of a nation's culture. Specifically, more must be done through the arts and humanities to nourish the nation's moral imagination. Constitutions, after all, are mechanisms of self-restraint. If men were angels, Madison observed, no government would be necessary. But since men are something less than angels, government, along with popular passions, must be curbed. This is the insight upon which all constitutionalism is based. And so long as our dominant culture remains infatuated with various forms of excess, and it scorns those who exhibit balance and decorum, the Constitution will remain the phantom that it is today.